Great to see everyone here this evening. Slightly smaller crowd, as I'm sure we've all noticed, but that doesn't hinder what we're going to do whatsoever. That is, look at a portion of Scripture. That is Matthew chapter 13, verses 24 through verse 43. Last week, we started discussing the parables that Jesus is teaching here, starting with the parable of the soils. I almost said parable of the sower, but it's really more about the soil rather than the sower. So we talked about that last week. This week, we're going to look at three more parables and an explanation of a parable. And these are a little bit more straightforward, I believe, less ambiguity about them, but nevertheless show some very important lessons about the kingdom of heaven. So, we're going to start with question number one. Does anyone need a question sheet? That's okay. We're going to have the questions up here even if you do. So question number one, it was going to be for me, but since I'm doing the study, it's actually going to be for Bill. So that's how you get out of that if you're interested. Question number one, why would an enemy sow tares in a field of good seed, and how could they know that this was an enemy? Verses 24 through verse 28.
Well, tares refer to a darnel grass. I don't know what darnel grass is, but it must look like wheat. Smaller, and I think it's the seed head that turns black, is a dark color. I don't think it's the leaves itself of this tall grass. I'm not real sure about that. This idea of an enemy coming and sowing tares in your field was not uncommon in the Eastern culture, especially. The Romans even had a specific law against doing that kind of an act against your neighbor. So, you know, why would an enemy sow tares in a field of good seed? To create hardship on someone. I have malice toward you, or I have I want to get some vengeance. You know, so there's some kind of hard feelings. This tear seed would even had the potential of it could poison people. If you were to mix the wheat seed and the tear seed together in the flour and then bake with them, these tares were actually poisonous. How could they know that this was an enemy? Well, when the servants went to the master, the owner of the field, so they saw that this had grown up. They were able to see it, and the master knew that he had good seed. I doubt he, you know, it's kind of like we studied last week. When you think about if it's a field of any size, you know, you're not going to do that with just one person. So there's probably multiple people throwing seed, you know, and they would certainly logically question whether it was good seed. And so the master's, you know, no, this was good seed. So that would have given the owner of the field a heads up. It's like, wait a minute, this isn't normal. This isn't just a patch of weeds over here. This is everywhere. So, you know, I've been victimized.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Very good. Anyone else have a comment on question? Graham.
One thing that caught my attention that I hadn't seen previously, and I thought was really interesting. At the end of verse 24 there, it's talking about the fall of the California, 25. But while men slept, his enemy came and sowed tares among the wheat and went his way. Very end part there, and went his way. So he just came there after this, the farmer had spent lots of time taking everything to the ground up, making sure it was all good, and the seed just where he wanted it. And he came by, the true seed went his way. Just split-second thing. Mm-hmm. All it took to cause all this chaos was just this massive thing and went his way.
It's really good. I hadn't really thought about that either, but it's exactly what Satan does. He doesn't have to do nearly as much work to destroy things as it takes to build something. So, appreciate that point. Very good.
Well, I'll follow it up also.
Sure.
And we see that a lot of time when we're trying to convert somebody, and all of a sudden, one little thing, they're just off track, moves completely mm-hmm. after all effort spent.
Yeah, exactly. Dennis?
I didn't read the same word, but I was just kind of trying to think about why they would do that. He wasn't really surprised, so like Will said, that maybe that was a practice that was not uncommon to people. probably malice or you want to hurt your neighbor. I thought about the financial end of it. You know, if you can do that enough, you can limit the supply and the demand and go up for your field for a week.
Yeah, absolutely. Anyone else on question number one? All those are very true. And what struck me in this parable, as well as the parable prior, is that there's never a problem with the seed. The seed is always good. If there's any corruption, it's somewhere else. It's not with what is planted. It's not with what the Lord has sown. Perhaps in the case in this parable, that's never the problem. Is the seed itself. So yeah, very good points. Anything else on question number one? If not, let's move to question number two. This will be for Hunter. What is the reasoning for leaving the tares with the good seed? And is it spiritually healthy to be isolated with only Christians, such as communal living, verses 28 through 30?
That's
to Trace we go. Dennis, would you like to answer?
I'll try.
Okay.
What is the reason for leaving the tares of the good seed? Is it spiritually healthy to be isolated? Well, no, of course. So as far as, I think, let me see, I can't read my writing.
I know the feeling. I suffer from that also.
Well, the reasoning for leaving the tares is not partially destroy the wheat, the good seed. And then the second part, not at all. It's not good for communal living because our effectiveness in spreading the gospel could be almost rendered useless because there are no unbelievers to influence for Christ. Everybody is already a believer. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about if a soldier remains back at camp with his troops, there's no way they can be in battle for his cause. It can't be really affecting the outcome. Helping for victory in that capacity. The frontline soldiers are subduing the enemy and helping win the battle of the war. Using what we are learning in God's Word brings about maturity in the faith. I thought about Hebrews 5:14, that solid food belongs to those who are full of age, which is mature, mm-hmm. and it's those who, by reason of use, have their sense of exercise to serve the good people. So it's kind of like that.
Appreciate it. And Lauren.
No, I think this may have been one of the hottest questions. But I was struggling with the communal living part. So I'm just gonna address that part. So the context seems the weeds are professing Christians and with wicked teachings in the context, it seems to show the weeds as professing Christians with wicked teachings and ideas. So how would that be affected by communal living? Communal living, perhaps it would make it easier for a false teacher to influence a whole congregation because it would be hard to refute. And I was viewing this as in the context of this parable, in protecting the vines and the doctrine of the church. However, we see wickedness certainly also comes from friendliness with the world, James 4:4. So there's a contrast. Perhaps in a communal setting, the false teaching is repeated so often no one can distinguish it from fact. So there we have another contrasting view of Philippians 2:12, work out your own salvation, for yourself. Mm-hmm. But then I also thought about the context in this. We're talking about Pharisees. So here is an example of communal living in that they were interacting among themselves and have developed these traditions. And maybe perhaps that's where you came up with the question.
Okay, I'll admit, this is, in my mind, it makes sense, and I was able to come up with an answer because I was the one that was thinking about it through this lens. So I can understand for other people my lenses are very weird. So, any other, Bill?
Before you try to explain yourself, I kind of did a little bit like Lauren did. I was like, where did this question come from? But I got to thinking about it. I think it's kind of an interesting question. I understand what Dennis is saying. And so I started out, or what Dennis said, I started out saying, yes, communal living would be healthy for the Christian. But how can a Christian fulfill their charge to be the salt of the earth, you know, to influence others, Matthew 5:13. So I think it would be healthy, but it wouldn't be the right thing to do.
Yeah. Okay. Any other comments on this before I get into my explanation? Okay. So it is important to understand the context, and this was one of the things that I thought I was going to have to backtrack on myself a little bit when I actually started going in and studying it, because you look in the explanation down in verses, you look at verse 39, and verse 41. Depending on how you look at these verses will greatly depend on how you view the parable itself. So 39 says that the enemy that sowed them is the devil, the harvest is the end of the world, and the reapers, verse 38, the field is the world. So that's, you can either look at the field as the world, or verse 41, the Son of Man shall send forth his angels, and they shall gather out of his kingdom all things that offend, and them which do iniquity. So there's two schools of thought, which I didn't realize going in to studying this, that either the field that's being referred to here is the church, and that there are tares within the church and wheat within the church, or that this is talking about the world, and there are people that look like Christians, and then there are people that are actually Christians. There's a difference between those two things, those two groups of people. Kaufman, Clark, and Barnes seem to believe that it is teaching that it is the church. However, McGarvey, Criswell, and myself also believe that this is talking about the world in a larger sense. There's some reasons for that. And part of what Kaufman, Clark, and Barnes do, and others that hold this position, they look at it and say, because there are tares in the church, then that means we can't perform any kind of discipline within the church. The tares are supposed to grow in with the wheat, and the Lord's going to do the separating at the end. We can't make any judgments on those that are within the church. That's part of their argument with this. So that obviously creates some difficulties. McGarvey's explanation is that this parable and its explanation are sometimes urged as an argument against church discipline, but such a use of them is clearly erroneous. The field is not the church, but the world, and the teaching of the parable is that we are not to attempt to exterminate evil men. And any who attempt to exterminate heretics in the name of Christ by physical force are condemned by this parable. Criswell comments, but the church is not militant against those who refuse to accept her gospel. It is not the external mission of the church to bear the sword against heretics or to change the world through political upheaval. So, for those reasons, and a few others perhaps, I believe that this is talking about the world, and that there are wheat and tares in the world, and then when the judgment comes, the Lord's going to separate those out. Now, as far as the communal living, this is where I get this from. So when you look at, if that's the case, the angels offer right at the beginning, why don't we take the tares out and leave the wheat in? They say, the Lord says, no, lest you root up both at the same time. So that's where the question comes from. Is communal living, that of living without tares, healthy? And part of what I learned in studying about tares, which Darnell is the plant. I never heard of Darnell before. But part of what happens is the roots of it and the wheat get tangled with one another, making it very possible and probable that you're going to pull the wheat up with the tare if you try to remove it. So when you're talking about communal living, and part of what I go back to is that of the Amish. And part of what they do, they stay to themselves, as we know, as a general rule at least. And part of that is to make sure that they keep each other holy. They keep each other in check, and they don't have outside influences. So I started to think about John chapter 17, verse 15, which says, I pray not that thou shouldest take them out of the world, but that thou shouldest keep them from the evil. And 1 Corinthians 5, 9 through 13, I wrote unto you in an epistle not to company with fornicators. This is also a good verse in context. If this parable was talking about the church, then these verses would seem very odd. So he says, not to company with fornicators, not altogether with the fornicators of this world, or with the covetous, or extortioners, or with idolaters. For then you must needs go out of the world. But now have I written unto you not to keep company if any man that is called a brother be a fornicator, covetous, idolater, or railer, drunkard, or extortioner. With such one know not to eat. For what have I to do to judge them also that are without? Do not ye judge them that are within. But them that are without God judgeth. Therefore put away from you, from among yourselves that wicked person. So that's, in a convoluted way, what I got out of these verses. And that may not make a whole lot of sense, but there's a reason why we live amongst the tares. And it's not because the Lord approves of the tares. It's not because the tares do any necessary good for us, but it's necessary for us to do so, like Dennis said, so that we can shine our light forth, so that we can convert those that are lost. In that way, and that's where communal living falls short. Because yes, it would be very nice. In fact, light shines brighter amongst other light, right? Well, it doesn't shine brighter. It's actually, it's not as brilliant as a light shining in the darkness. That's what we talked about back in chapter 5 with the light, the city set on a hill that cannot be hidden. So that's my explanation. After that, are there any comments on that? Okay. So we're going to move on to question number 3. This is going to be for Grant. How is the church like a mustard seed? Verses 31 and 32.
Least of all seeds, the gospel message is simple, but it's foolishness to sophisticated worldly people. We see this for 1 Corinthians 1:18, and we also know that Christ himself was not a handsome superstar type individual, Isaiah 53:2-3. The message, however, spread throughout the world as commanded, Matthew 28:19. So here's where I thought was interesting. Daniel 2:34-35 and 43-45, we see a similar verse, or similar concept in this small stone that grows to, it crushes the feet of the great image and becomes a great mountain and fills the whole earth. In Daniel 4:11-12, the kingdom of Babylon under Nebuchadnezzar is likened to a tree with great branches, and it has burrs in the branches. So in 13:19, we see it's burrs. So there is some speculation on what's the burrs. Maybe it benefits people, as Grant said, just regular people throughout society. Maybe the burrs are the, you know, good people, great people that are part of the church. Or if you go back to the previous parable, birds are wicked. So perhaps the birds represent wicked people that have polluted the church. And that, we go back to 13:19, or this chapter. For anyone hears the word of the kingdom and does not understand it, then the wicked one comes and snatches away what was sown in his heart. And, you know, when the parable was given, that's the bird. And then as Matt was reading it, I also saw another opportunity for this to be a wicked bird, and that it's the birds of the air. And we think of Satan as the prince of the power of the air.
Mm-hmm. Very good. I hadn't dove quite as deep into the birds of the air, but those are very interesting points. Appreciate it. Anyone else? Question number 3. Bill.
Ezekiel 31, 3 through 9 is another passage. Lauren referenced Daniel 4, 11 and 12, but Ezekiel 33, 3 through 9 is another passage that describes or compares the kingdom to a tree. A large, mature tree. And there was a passage in Revelations, I can't remember what it was, like chapter 18 or something, that talked about the birds in the trees being evil. Mm-hmm.
If only Bart was here. Very good. Anything else on question number 3? Okay, let's move on to question number 4. Similar parable, this will be for Lauren. How is the church like leaven? Verse 33 through 35.
Well, in this verse, which a woman took, and so we often see church equated to a woman. So there's a good parallel there. Leaven is the word of God in the gospel message. So leaven gently spreads through the dough, causing it to rise. The gospel message has been spread throughout the world by peace, converting hearts. It affects all, even the unbelieving. It began in Jerusalem. See Acts 2, and then it goes to Antioch and Asia Minor and Acts 11 and beyond. Isaiah 2:2, all nations of the world shall flow to it. And way back at the beginning, Genesis 22:18, in your seed all the nations shall be blessed. That's a promise to Abraham. So the blessings of Jesus have spread through all the world. Now, where this parable differs from most other uses is that leaven is good. I mean, almost every other aspect, leaven is shown as a contaminating agent, but here it's given as shows its infectious nature.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Matt?
I think the idea here and in the previous parable is that these are two things that are very unassuming, and their impact is widespread. But even the mustard, the church isn't compared to the mustard tree. It's the mustard seed, and what comes out of it produces the tree. What comes out of the leaven, a very little bit of it, can, of course, leaven the whole lump, to quote scripture elsewhere. But leaven itself is very unassuming, so a little bit of it will cause all of this to leaven, and we need to think about that when we think about how we enact change in the world. Every interaction that we have with another person is maybe the most unassuming thing that you can think of. It's not an article in the New York Times. It's not a Facebook post or a Twitter post. It's not an election, a war. It's the little interactions that we have that can save one person at a time.
Absolutely true. Absolutely true. And just, and like Lauren mentioned, leaven's often used in regard to sin. the process of those two are very similar, because sin is something you don't just decide one day to just go head first into sin. It's something that builds over time, something that accumulates, starts within the heart, and then eventually it manifests in what we do. Similar with the church, it starts very small, it's unassuming, like you said, Matt, and then it has built and built and built until it is where it is today, and it's done so in a non-assuming way, with the little things, non-violent things, might add, but unlike a lot of religions, the church is not a conquering nation. We don't go out trying to win people through violence, but it's something that's gradual, takes time, and works in the hearts of men that way. Any other comments on question number four? Dennis.
I was just thinking of this week, Matt said the process. I saw like the exponential growth. You know, one person tells somebody, things like that, and how it kind of just really helps us with what we're doing. That's the way that it's going to be spread. Mm-hmm. Acts 17, where we talk about the apostles or Paul, these men would turn the world upside down. One man awakens another, second awakens his next door neighbor, and three awake can rouse the town and turn the whole place upside down. And many awake can raise such a fuss, and finally awakens the rest of us. One man up with dawn in his eyes multiplies.
Very good. I like that poem, that's good. Any other comments on question number four? If not, let's move on to question number five. This will be Brother Matt Kuderna. Are people predestined to be either good seed or tares according to this parable? Can you change what you are? Verses 36 through 38.
We have to be careful with Bible imagery, especially a parable, which is a made-up story, to make it say more than it does. In this case, saying that making a free will argument out of this parable is a non sequitur. It's nowhere near what this parable is talking about. Because especially if seeds are likened to the church, which they seem to be in this list of parables. And he says in verse 38, the field is the world, the good seeds are sons of the kingdom. So let's imagine that these seeds are not the beginning point, because the sons of the kingdom, there are steps that you have to take before you can become that seed. So we're starting at a point where we have sons of the kingdom and we have sons of the devil, and those two are mixed together. Now, of course, a tare seed cannot become a wheat seed, but that's not the point of the parable. The point of the parable is that those will grow together, and they have to grow together, because you can't take one out before the other. So, to answer the question, can you change what you are? Yes. But that's not what the parable is talking about. The parable is not making a free will.
That's right. That's absolutely right. And it's, again, I appreciate what you said. It's about time. We're dropped into this specific point in time. And that's not what the purpose of this parable is. Appreciate that. Any other comments on question number five? Okay. Let's move on to question number six. And this will be for Malin. Why is this a good parable to combat premillennialism? 37 through 43.
Yeah, because it refutes what they believe, the premillennialism. It says it Christ will come and set up a kingdom.
I've got us a chart here.
Okay.
Might help a little bit.
Yeah. So that kind of refutes that because of what it says, the earth will be burned with fire. Tell us that there won't be like a physical kingdom, what they're referring to. So, and I have verse 1 Corinthians 15 and 24 through 28. You can read that. I don't have my Bible with me, so.
Say it again.
1 Corinthians 15 and 24 through 28.
Then cometh the end when he shall have delivered up the kingdom to God, even the Father. He shall have put down all rule and authority and power, for he must reign till he hath put all enemies under his feet. The last enemy that shall be destroyed is death, for he hath put all things under his feet. But when he saith all things are put under him, it is manifest that he is accepted, which put all things under him. And when all things shall be subdued unto him, then shall the Son also himself be subject unto him that put all things under him, that God may be all in all. Anyone else on question number 6? Lauren.
Well, I don't know that I necessarily agree that it's a good parable to combat premillennialism for the same reasons that it's not a good comparison to show what we had in the previous verse, predestination. It has to be combined with other verses, just mm-hmm. like the predestination has to be explained away by other verses. Mm-hmm. You couldn't use this alone to show that.
Correct.
That being said, they would have had to store the tares in straw bales for 1,000 years. But we see other verses such as Hebrews 9:27. Mm-hmm. It's appointed for men to die once, and 2 Thessalonians 1:7
mm-hmm.
to 9 that show us. But again, I think we always need to combine them. Solid.
Correct. Me and my lens, I look at, kind of pick out this one part that I like out of this, but that's absolutely true. You can't just take this by itself, just like the past verses. And this is sometimes something that we have a problem with, is making parables say more than they're supposed to say. Jesus tells us what this parable is saying. Now, yes, there are certain things that we can look at and say, oh, there's application here, there's application here. But we should always be careful not to cross the interpretation with the application. What this parable is talking about doesn't necessarily have to do with combating premillennialism. That's not the point of the parable, but combined with other verses, it can be a decent argument. Matt.
I'm glad you have this chart that has the two types of premillennialism,
mm-hmm.
because most people that you run into in the evangelical community now are going to be number two. They're going to be dispensational premillennialists,
mm-hmm.
which do believe that the wheat, if you will be taken before the tares in the rapture doctrine.
Right.
So that does apply here, and not so much to the historic view of premillennialism, but
mm-hmm.
most people we encounter will be dispensational premillennialists, and they
yes.
will think that.
Yes. Yeah. That is a good point. The historic is what this first one, historic premillennialism, it's closer. It's not exactly right. Dispensationalism, premillennialism, is just a nightmare. There's no redeeming qualities about it. Postmillennialism is actually what a lot of the early restoration preachers were, particularly Alexander Campbell. That's why his paper that he put out was called The Millennial Harbinger. And their thought, and postmillennialism, is the thought that they were bringing in, because of their preaching, a 1,000-year reign, uninterrupted 1,000-year reign of Christianity. That's what they were trying to do. So if you're reading through some of those old restoration preachers, you may find aspects of postmillennialism. Amillennialism, is what I believe the correct view to be, as well, I'm sure everyone here, is that it's a symbolic millennium. We're not talking about a literal thousand years, that the Lord is going to reign and then comes the end time. And this parable doesn't support that either. It doesn't say anything about Jesus coming back and having a physical reign. He doesn't work that into the parable. He doesn't. He gives it very straightforward. And this is a good blueprint to look at, because if we miss the blueprint here, which is so very simple, the field is the world, the good seed are the children of the kingdom, the tares are the children of the wicked one, the enemy is the devil, the harvest is the end of the world, the reapers are the angels. Straightforward. The good are going to be rewarded, the evil are going to be punished in eternity, and that's going to be the end of the world. And this is one difference that I prefer the King James. I'll just throw this out there. I prefer the King James over the New King James, because New King James says end of the age. Now, if you're talking to a premillennialist, a dispensational one in particular, they say the end of the age, that may be the rapture, that may be the tribulation, that may be the millennium. These are ages to them, and they'll might use that terminology. So that's why I prefer the end of the world, as the King James puts it, as opposed to the end of the age. Again, that is a personal preference. I'm not forcing that on anyone, but that's one reason why I like to preach out of the King James when you're looking at those type of passages. So just throw that out there, because y'all are talking to me about King James Version, so... any other questions or comments on question number 6? Okay. Well, this will conclude our study this evening.